Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What's the relationship between power in the entertainment industry and influence over the direction of American politics? Conventional wisdom has it that the country's left coast is run almost entirely by those whose politics lean in that same direction. But as my guest today has discovered, a long-term examination of the movie business reveals a far more balanced history of political influence from Hollywood and nearly a century of recognition that cinema can have a huge impact on voters' opinions on important issues and on their actions at the ballot box. Film historian Stephen J. Ross is chairman of the History Department at the University of Southern California. His new book is called Hollywood Left and Right, How Movie Stars Shaped American Politics. Steve, welcome to Think.
Thanks, Chris.
So you don't argue the fact that there are more left-leaning individuals working within Hollywood, but you're convinced that the right has actually exercised more influence per capita on American politics. Talk about that.
Yeah, there's no question about it that the Hollywood left has always been more numerous and more visible than the Hollywood right. But if you take a look at electoral politics and take a look at national policy and you ask, you know, who's had a greater impact on the very nature of American government? To my mind, it's the Hollywood right. And one of the reasons I would argue that is if you look at American politics in the 20th century, I would suggest there are two foundational moments. One is the creation of the New Deal under Franklin Roosevelt, and the second is the effort to dismantle the New Deal that began under a former movie star, Ronald Reagan. And no left star has had the kind of impact Reagan did. But more to the point, what I try to show is that the Hollywood left has generally focused on what I would call issue-oriented politics. That is, they appear at various moments in time, whether it's the 1930s and dealing with the rise of Hitler and fascist movements in Europe, or the 1950s dealing with civil rights, or the 60s and 70s dealing with anti-war and women's movement, and up through today, it can be Darfur, it can be any cause. You have celebrities coming out for particular causes. That has characterized the left, but if you take a look at the right, you've had a very small number, but very powerful number of people who have really helped shape American electoral politics, starting with Louis B. Mayer in the 20s, and then his protege was George Murphy, who became California senator in 1964, and Murphy, in turn, mentored Ronald Reagan. Reagan, in turn, mentored Charlton Heston. And then the last person I profile in my book is Arnold Schwarzenegger, not mentored by any of them, but still, you know, rising up to become governor of the, most powerful state in the union.
And Schwarzenegger sort of represents a new era in some ways in using the media in politics, in that he recognized that he didn't necessarily need to eschew coverage from things like Access Hollywood and Entertainment Tonight.
Right. It's very right that in the book, I profile 10 people, 5 on the left and 5 on the right, and Schwarzenegger is my last chapter. And part of the reason I end with him is he represents yet another kind of political activism. And if I can just backtrack one moment.
Sure.
One of the things that got me really interested when I started this book about 10 years ago was, how do we begin to think about politics? And, you know, most of us think about it as either it's an election time or it's a specific issue.
Mm-hmm.
And that Hollywood celebrities either come out to endorse certain candidates or they come out for certain causes. And what I discovered is, in fact, political activism in America and political activism within Hollywood is, in fact, much more complicated. It's more diverse and deeper than people think. So that one of the things I try to do is talk about 6 different kinds of political activism, from visual politics to electoral politics to issue-oriented politics to movement politics to image politics. And finally, we get to Arnold Schwarzenegger, what I call the new age of celebrity politics.
Hmm.
in that what Schwarzenegger's election as governor showed is you no longer have to have deep roots in a political party, because everyone I interviewed agreed that, you know, had he run in a traditional campaign and had to go through a traditional primary in the Republican Party, he never would have gotten the nomination from the Republicans because he's far too liberal on social issues. But because he ran in this special recall, you know, tradition would have it that the election should have been won by one of the two-party stalwarts who had deep connections to the sort of Democratic Party apparatus or the Republican Party apparatus, either Cruz Bustamante, who had been lieutenant governor, or Tom McClintock, who was in the local state senator in California. But instead, Arnold won. And what he won is on celebrity, that he devised an entirely different kind of political strategy. That in the past, you always had politicians and celebrities who would go, celebrities who were running for office, they would go on various shows. You had as early as 1960, for example, you had John Kennedy and Richard Nixon going on the Jack Parr show. And we know that, you know, Bill Clinton's ratings went up after he went on Arsenio Hall. And other politicians have done this. But Schwarzenegger was the first one. For those traditional politicians, going on these entertainment shows was peripheral to their campaign. And they focused on traditional, you know, beating the campaign trail, and then particularly talking with what I would call, quote, serious media outlets, the New York Times, the L.A. Times, Wall Street Journal, Meet the Press, stuff like this. But Schwarzenegger knew that those places did not particularly like him, had no support for him, and so he went on the shows where he was well-liked, like Entertainment Tonight, Access Hollywood E!, and it was smart because he understood that they would also allow him not only to get publicity, but to give him as much time as he wanted to talk about what he would do without asking him hard policy questions.
Because it's not their job to grill politicians for the most part.
That's right. And what he also did is he realized that by going on these shows, because at first, you know, I'll admit, I thought, boy, this is kind of a lightweight strategy. Mm-hmm. And then I realized, no, you know, the more I looked into all of these 10 people, the more I realized they were much savvier, much smarter than anyone gave them credit for, including myself. And that what he understood is those entertainment shows were appealing to the 50% of the voters who never vote in presidential elections, let alone in, you know, gubernatorial elections. And that by reaching them on these entertainment shows, he might be able to mobilize a group of voters who usually don't vote and could put him over the top. And, in fact, that's what happened. He got both he drew from Republican, Democrat, and he drew also from people who don't vote.
So let's go back in history a little bit, Steve, and talk about the early days of Hollywood itself as an entertainment capital, because initially the film industry was sort of scattered all over the country, and then Charlie Chaplin and others recognized that this was a place where the sun shone and you could get good lighting even during the winter months when you had to sort of shut down operations elsewhere.
Right, and the real key here is, again, you know, the fun thing about writing books that you haven't written before is you learn stuff. And I'd always assumed that, you know, Hollywood was Hollywood right from the start. And what I discovered is, no, from 1905 when the first Nickelodeon opened until 1914 when World War I broke out, production was scattered around the country. The movie industry was, you know, really kind of an artisanal phase where everybody in basically every city was able to make films. And with the outbreak of World War I, it presented filmmakers with an extraordinary business opportunity because suddenly European filmmaking had to shut down because of the war. And American producers realized that they could capture the world industry, but they would have to double their production. And people who were in New York, Philadelphia, Chicago, Boston, they had a hard time shooting because they were limited by the weather, by the possibility of different kinds of sets. And they realized, you know what, if we went out west, we have both over 300 days a year of summer, plus the landscape is such that you could go right out to do a pirate movie in Santa Monica Bay. You could, go literally a few miles and do cowboy movies up in the hills. You could go out to a desert. You could go into the city. And so by the end of World War One, the United States was producing, close to 90% of the world's films, and Hollywood became the center of world production.
How deliberate was Charlie Chaplin's emphasis on his left-leaning politics?
Excuse me?
How deliberate was Charlie Chaplin's decision to make films that reflected his politics?
Well, I would argue it was a slow evolutionary process. It's a good question, because at first, what I would suggest is his politics were, I call him an instinctual radical, because if you look at his history, if Charles Dickens were to write a biography of Chaplin, he would call it Declining Expectations, because Chaplin actually grew up initially in a fairly well-to-do home. His parents were both entertainers, music hall entertainers, but then his father started drinking, and his mother left the father, and she was a marginal entertainer, and when she got ill and lost her voice, she couldn't entertain at all, and they had to pawn everything. And they kept moving from a multi-bedroom apartment with a maid to two-bedroom and then a one-bedroom. And eventually she was sent to a hospital/asylum, and her two young boys, Chaplin at the age of six, along with his older brother Sid, were sent to a workhouse. To this place called Hanwell's, where boys were beaten on a regular basis. Chaplin was beaten for setting a fire he never set, and he argued that this really left him with this very strong anti-authoritarian sentiment, and that was only enforced by when he finally got out with his mother, kind of being hassled by church officials, by reformers, by police, that he felt none of these so-called authorities ever cut his family any sympathy or any slack. And it left him with this lifelong hatred of authority figures. And that's where the tramp started. The tramp started as somebody who was less overtly political in a left or right sense as in a power sense, that anybody in power was the subject of, the tramp's actions. And particularly, anybody who gave working people or immigrants a hard time, so landlords, employers, the idle rich. At first, Chaplin was afraid to become overtly political because he was afraid that, standard wisdom in the industry at the time was shut your mouth on politics because the moment you open it, you alienate half your audience.
Mm-hmm.
And Chaplin was always afraid of falling back into poverty. And the irony is the more fame he got as a movie star, the more world intellectuals wanted to see him. So when he did a tour of Europe in the 1920s, he was like meeting with all the great political and intellectual leaders of the country, the H.G. Wells and people like this. And again, in the 30s, he would travel and meet these intellectuals, and foreign newspapers would ask him his opinion on foreign affairs, and by the 1930s, his films got increasingly political in the 20s. In the 30s, he made Modern Times, which is a critique of, industrialization. But he finally reached the moment he never thought he would reach. He reached when he made The Great Dictator, which was an attack on Hitler and Mussolini and the Nazis and the fascists, and was the first major Hollywood film to talk about concentration camps.
Let me jump in here. We need to take a quick break. My guest this hour is film historian Stephen J. Ross. He's chair of the history department at USC and author of the new book, Hollywood Left and Right, How Movie Stars Shaped American Politics.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
Yeah. You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with film historian Stephen J. Ross. His new book is called Hollywood Left and Right, How Movie Stars Shaped American Politics. You can be part of the conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org. And Steve, before the break, you were in the middle of telling us about the really groundbreaking subject matter dealt with in The Great Dictator.
Right, and what I was saying is this is the first time Chaplin spoke on the screen, and he learned two things from this. At the very end of the film, it's all silent until the very end when it's a tale of Chaplin plays two people, this tailor, a barber rather, and he plays Adolf Henkel, basically a parody of Hitler.
Mm-hmm.
And the two men get confused at the end, and he has to go up and address the German troops at a kind of Nuremberg-like rally. And he speaks for the first time, and it's a very heartfelt speech, very sincere speech, calling for humanism and put down, you know, your weapons, and really, do we want to destroy one another and make war? And Chaplin thought this was, you know, just a kind of liberal appeal, and he discovered two things. First, audiences don't want comedians to be serious. And he got killed in the reviews, by and large, people saying, you're not funny, you know, and we don't want you talking and giving us your political opinion. And the second thing he learned is when movie stars give a political opinions on foreign affairs that are in advance of public opinion, they suffer for it. And that was the end of his career, basically. From then on, his career went down, down, down. And in the late 40s and 50s, when he made films, he was constantly being picketed by the American Legion and anti-communist groups because his appeal for world speech was interpreted by the right and conservatives in America as a communist appeal. And Chaplin's career basically came to an end.
So let's switch to the other side of things and talk a little bit about Louis B. Mayer, who recognized very early on that given his power in the studio system, he had access to a very important political tool. Tell us a little bit about him.
Right, and that's, again, one of the surprising findings I had is not only was the Hollywood right more powerful politically, but that the conservatives have a longer history in Hollywood than liberals. Hmm. And it was Louis B. Mayer in the late 1920s who cemented the first permanent relationship between a party and a studio. And he turned MGM into a kind of publicity wing for the GOP. And what Mayer also understood, Mayer moved up within the Republican ranks. So by the 1930s, he was the head of the California GOP. And in 1928, he helped broker a meeting between William Randolph Hearst, who was a very prominent Democrat, and Herbert Hoover, who was looking, a good friend of Mayer's, looking for the Republican nomination. And he basically got Hearst to agree he would support Hoover on the first ballot, which was enough to put him over the top. So Mayer was able to help broker a presidential nomination. But then he also got involved with the convention politics and argued that if Republicans were going to appeal to a mass audience, they had to make their convention more interesting. And by the late 20s, things were being broadcast on radio. And so he really took over and tried to make the convention more radio-friendly and entertaining. And again, he did the same thing in 1932. He really was the first Hollywood figure to see the important role that mass media and particularly Hollywood glamour could play in elections. And he constantly tried to do this and bring out Republican stars to campaign with Republican candidates. And he also turned his studio into a Republican salon that was training young stars like George Murphy, Robert Montgomery, Robert Taylor in Republican ideology. He would have meetings of these young stars. He would bring in outside speakers. And by the 1940s, when you take a look at the conservative movement in Hollywood, particularly this group called the Motion Picture Alliance for the Preservation of American Democracy, which is the group that invited HUAC to come to Hollywood, they're dominated overwhelmingly by MGM personnel. And again, as I mentioned, Mayer trains or mentors George Murphy. Murphy, in turn, mentors Reagan. So you've got this Republican trajectory going from the 20s right through the 80s.
How directly did Mayer's politics impact the kinds of scripts even submitted to MGM for consideration?
Well, it's interesting you ask, because the bottom line for Louis B. Mayer was the bottom line. He loved making money, and he loved being a success, and he loved the adulation that came with it. So first and foremost, he designed films, or greenlit films, approved films, that he thought would appeal to audiences and make his studio money. When it came to, you know, movies, money, profits, and politics, politics was at the end. But that said, if he could, he loved to see the kind of films that espoused his vision of America and the kind of values and visions that would ultimately wind up in Ronald Reagan's Morning in America speech. And he did this most successfully through the Andy Hardy series. It's Andy Hardy, but it's the Hardy Family series starring Mickey Rooney. This was the most popular series in MGM history, more money than anything else. And it was basically his core Republican ideology that you don't need to trust government, that all you need is family, God, and patriotism.
If
you have that, everything will work out. And never turn to the government. Turn to your family and turn to what you know to be the patriotic best.
What's so interesting about that is that it was not, I can't imagine it was completely obvious to audiences who went to see these, you know, sort of happy stories about this teenage boy and his father, the judge. And it didn't probably seem to them that they were watching something that would influence how they felt about their country.
Yeah, and that's where the most effective politics comes. George Bernard Shaw once wrote about the movies. He thought they were the most effective propaganda medium around. He said, because as an audience, you go in only thinking you're being entertained. But in fact, you're being fed all this propaganda about how the world works in a kind of natural order. And what seems to be natural is not natural, but is really ideology. Nevertheless, because you think you're being entertained, you don't see it as that, and you sort of walk out. And what Shaw and others would say is that it's the repetition of these kind of images and values over and over again that begin to shape our worldview. So if kids grow up learning how to kiss, how to dress, how to smoke a cigarette from, you know, watching movies, they also learn very subtly what their politics may be from watching movies.
You mentioned HUAC finally sort of descending on Hollywood. A lot of Americans post-World War II were terrified of communism. Talk a little bit about what happened to Edward G. Robinson and the role that he had played in what became his own demise.
Right. Well, HUAC, for listeners who are not familiar, was the House Un-American Activities Committee, and they actually started in the 1930s. At a time, you had all these extremist groups on the left and the right. You had the communists on the left, and you had Nazi groups, which people today don't realize. They were very prominent Nazi groups, silver shirts, black shirts, marching in the streets of L.A., having a Nazi summer camp in the Valley in Los Angeles. And many movie stars became very concerned about this, and they became politically active. Well, Congress was concerned about the spread of radicalism. They created this committee. It was supposed to investigate groups on the left and right, but from the start, it really ignored fascist and Nazi groups and focused on communist groups. And when the war broke out, it suspended its activity. But it picked it up in 45, and particularly by 1947, and came to Hollywood to investigate communist propaganda. Well, you did have a Communist Party operating in Hollywood, and it's important to remember that according to the Constitution, we did have freedom of speech, and there was nothing outlawing the Communist Party, so that was all legal. And the FBI was investigating them, and HUAC came in because they were afraid communists were inserting propaganda into the movies, that these writers and directors and producers and actors were all, you know, taking communist propaganda into the movies. And one could understand that would be frightening, particularly for a country that has said, you know, starting in 1919, our goal is to overthrow world capitalism. On the other hand, they had no real evidence. And so a left liberal like Edward G. Robinson, who I profile here, I argue that his story is, in fact, more compelling and more frightening than the story of the more familiar story of the Hollywood Ten, that is, the ten writers, directors, producers who refused to testify and were sent to jail for a year. And everyone in Hollywood knew that they were either communists, former communists, or very far to the left. And so they weren't surprised. They didn't like it. They were outraged, but they weren't shocked when UEC went after the most radical members of the Hollywood community. But Edward G. Robinson was a left liberal. He was not a communist, didn't believe in it. He believed in the Bill of Rights, and he believed in the Constitution, which, you know, basically says all men are entitled to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. And he argued that we need to be speaking out on what we believe in, and that, you know, the Communist Party's still legal. So, you know, not that I'm a communist, but they're still legal. And he was very outspoken in denouncing Nazism and then really denouncing what he thought were the overkill of HUAC. And by 1950, he got blacklisted, because he never thought he'd be blacklisted because he wasn't a communist.
Mm-hmm.
And when he was blacklisted, his career came to an end. And I would argue that proved more frightening to many people in Hollywood, because they began saying, if HUAC can go after a left liberal like Eddie Robinson, then none of us are safe.
And Robinson essentially had felt like if the communists are willing to stand up against fascism, then let's welcome them aboard.
Right. He was typical, I would argue, of liberals and left liberals of the time, which is he did not particularly like the Communist Party. He didn't like the communists. He didn't particularly like some of the leaders who he thought were a little too outspoken and arrogant. But he also felt that he would, as he wrote in his autobiography, I would unite with anybody who was willing to fight Hitler, whether it was communists, Daughters of the American Revolution, Holy Rollers. Anyone who would fight Hitler is somebody I will consider my ally. And he thought that was the more important battle than sectarian battles over politics.
What sort of reception was there, Steve, to his autobiography? Did people read this, or was even that something that nobody wanted to touch?
Well, I think by the time his autobiography came out, he was, you know, old news.
Mm-hmm.
But people were following his trial in the early 50s, because once he was blacklisted, he actually asked to testify before HUAC to clear his name, and it never worked. In the end, he, as he wrote in his autobiography, you know, I had to lie. I had to tell them what they wanted to hear, which was that I was duped by the communists, that I never knew what was going on. And here's a man who is considered the most intellectual figure of his age in Hollywood. He spoke six languages. He had the largest and most impressive private collection of Impressionist art in the United States. And he knew exactly what was going on, but in order to salvage his career, he lied, and in his autobiography said he never forgave himself for lying, that it always left this sort of pit in his stomach, that he told them what he wanted, what they wanted to hear, and he kowtowed.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We're speaking this hour with Stephen J. Ross about his new book, Hollywood Left and Right, How Movie Stars Shaped American Politics. Let's go on the phone now to Sam in Fort Worth. Hello, Sam.
Yes, well, the case of Edward G. Robinson illustrates my point. Never mind the money. Actors are hired hands. And Matt Damon tomorrow could simply not get work because of executive whims, and this tends to put you towards the left and make you a member of a union.
What do you think about that, Steve?
Well, I think in the I would disagree only to the extent that in the end producers are looking. You know, there is a division between what I would call corporate Hollywood and creative Hollywood. Creative Hollywood are your actors, your writers, your directors, and they have always tended to be on the left. Corporate Hollywood, even if you have individuals, the studio heads may be liberal in their personal politics, but they are always concerned from the beginning, and I've looked through producer records starting in 1915, it's the bottom line that concerns them. So you could even get Louis D. Mayer at the height of HUAC. He had a writer who was a known communist, and he said to that writer, you know, I will, and Mayer was one of the most outspoken anti-communists. He met with him privately and said, look, I'll double your salary if you agree to, you know, split with those commies, because his scripts were bringing him in huge profits. And the writer refused to do it, and at that point, Mayer had to get rid of him. But if Matt Damon makes money for a studio, the studio is not going to get rid of him unless he makes some statement that is so outrageous, you know, of a Mel Gibson type, that there's such a backlash against him that he can't make movies anymore. And if your listeners remember, at the beginning of the first Iraq War, Sean Penn argued that he was he had signed a contract and to make a film, and that film was pulled because he made anti-war comments. Well, since then, he's still gone on to make movies. If a movie star can make you money, his or her politics won't matter unless they're really extreme.
I guess you could make the same argument about Bill Maher, who experienced something similar.
That's right, and Bill Maher bounces back. So he's kicked off ABC for a while, and he bounces back to HBO.
My guest this hour is Stephen J. Ross. We're speaking about his new book, Hollywood Left and Right, How Movie Stars Shaped American Politics. Steve, of course, is a film historian and chair of the History Department at the University of Southern California. We'll take more of your calls and emails after this break. You can get to us by phoning 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a self-designed program that allows an unconventional approach to your graduate education. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Film historian Stephen J. Ross is with us this hour. He's chair of the History Department at USC and author of the new book, Hollywood Left and Right, How Movie Stars Shaped American Politics. You could join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Steve, I think it's really interesting when you trace the sort of ideological lineage that went from Louis B. Mayer to George Murphy to Ronald Reagan to Charlton Heston. Right in the center with the two who held elected political office, they also shared involvement, elected involvement in the Screen Actors Guild. Was that a place where they sort of cut their political teeth?
Yeah, it really was. And all of them argue that's what gave them a taste for politics. Well, they had always been interested in politics, mm-hmm. but Murphy was the head of the Screen Actors Guild before Reagan, and then Reagan became head of the guild, and later on Charlton Heston became head of the guild. And it was both learning to negotiate, and particularly for Reagan, who had been a liberal Democrat at the end of World War II, it was his post-war experience as a SAG leader during studio strikes from 1945 through 1947 that pushed him over into the anti-communist wing and of the Democrats, and then later into the Republican anti-communist wing.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We'll go back to the phones now. This time we have Jeff on the line in Dallas. Hi, Jeff.
Hi. I just want to know if you could comment on, I guess the Pentagon has a liaison office. I guess that came to light to most of the public back when Osama bin Laden was killed. And I guess there was some congressmen complaining that the administration was somehow manipulating Hollywood.
What do you know about that, Steve?
Well, after 9/11, Karl Rove came out to Hollywood and met with the head of all the studios and the networks and basically said to them, we would, you know, we're not going to tell you what to make, but we really would encourage you to make films that, you know, promoted a patriotic view of this war on terror. And I had spoken to somebody who was there who told me, you know, the hair on the back of his neck went up because he felt there was a very subtle threat that if you don't do this, you know, there'll be action against you. But this isn't anything new. You know, early on, it went both ways. You had studio heads like Mayer. One of the reasons he was also courting the Republican Party was he then had access to power figures in Washington, and he was able to get military equipment at virtually no cost to use in his movies. He was able to get State Department to help him shoot in Europe. But in return, you know, he would make patriotic films. But then in World War One, you have the government much more heavy-handed than after 9/11, creating the Committee on Public Information. And I've gone through records finding that, you know, the studios were told, we want you to make happy movies. We don't want you to release or to re-release any film that casts aspersions on America, meaning films about class conflict, racism, sexism. And at first, Adolf Zucker, who was then head of Paramount, said, you can't tell us what to make. Forget it. And then Creel sent him a letter saying, that's fine, you know, you make what you want, but, you know, we've given movie industry personnel exemption from military service, and we've also allowed you to stay open in the evening and use up more coal and, you know, supplies than we would any other industry. So that's fine. If you don't cooperate with us, we're going to take away your exemption, and you're going to have to shut your theaters in the evening. And a week later, Zucker wrote back saying, we would be happy to make happy films about America that only portrayed positive things. So, you know, the government has always been pressuring. The same thing happened during World War II. So this is nothing new. The government has always realized that the movie industry can be a powerful form of propaganda. And, you know, to the extent they could, they've tried to get that propaganda in their favor rather than against them.
We've talked a lot about men this hour, but maybe you can speak for a few minutes about how Jane Fonda has exercised political power over the years.
Well, she's really interesting because Jane Fonda is the only woman I have in the book, mainly because of, you know, if you're really looking at powerful figures who have not just influenced things for a few years, Jane Fonda was politically active for decades. And had a very interesting story of starting off very much as a political naive with her heart in seemingly the right place if you were against the war. She came back from France in 1970. And I interviewed a number of people who were very much involved in the anti-war movement, who were leaders of the anti-war movement. And one of them gave me a quote saying, you know, he thought Jane Fonda actually did more harm than good because she attracted a lot of attention. But she made a lot of gaffes. She didn't really know the history. She didn't really know the complexity of the anti-war movement. You know, and as she writes in her own biography, you know, she was shrill. She wanted to prove her radical credentials. And she wound up hurting the cause as much as she did helping it. But to her credit, when the war, by 1972, she had met Tom Hayden. And one of the things that sets her apart, there are four people in the book, I argue, who take politics to a whole nother level, and it's what I call movement politics. That is, people who were not interested simply in just one election, but set out to transform America. That they believed the very nature of the government had to be changed in radical ways. And the two people on the right were Murphy and Reagan, who wanted to overturn the New Deal. That it wasn't just an election. They wanted to change the fundamental structure of the American government. And on the left, it was Jane Fonda and Harry Belafonte, who wanted to limit the impact of capitalism, imperialism, sexism, and racism. And Fonda actually founded two grassroots mass movement groups, one called the Indochina Peace Committee in 72, and then several years later after the end of the war, the Committee for Economic Democracy that was calling, you know, that was calling on people to move to limit the power of government and corporate America. And the other thing she did that was interesting is not at the same time she had this mass movement trying to build a national constituency, she opened her own production company and was making movies that were dealing with the themes of her mass movement. So whether it was 9 to 5, whether it was coming home, dealing with the, you know, the anti-war movement, to dealing with nuclear power, she was making films that would try to politicize audiences on the screen at the same time she was trying to politicize people off the screen. So she had a, you know, a very interesting career, and then eventually, after, you know, roughly 30 years, said, I'm leaving mass movement politics.
We have an email here from David in Plano who wants to know more about Charlton Heston. David writes, how did this man who walked side by side with civil rights leaders during the 60s end up being the face of the NRA 40 years later?
Well, again, another interesting story. Heston was, I argue in the end, Heston was really a libertarian who did believe in the founding fathers. And as we know, that even though there were founding mothers there who were very influential, the founding fathers have been used by the left and the right. And Heston initially, like George Murphy and Ronald Reagan, started off as a liberal Democrat. And he was the first Hollywood star to march in a demonstration, civil rights demonstration in 1961 in Oklahoma City. He led the Hollywood contingent that went to Washington for the March on Washington in 63 and remained a liberal Democrat until 1972. And that's when the entire Democratic Party fractured. And Heston was part of that group that thought the Democrats, and particularly George McGovern, were far too radical. And so he became a leader of Democrats for Nixon. And by the 80s, he really cast his lot in with the conservatives. And over the, you know, his final 2 decades of life, really moved more and more into the conservative movement. It's a complicated story, and I tell it in the chapter, but he became convinced that the Democrats were destroying American values and really got very much into the culture war debate as well, and just wound up on the right.
Where do you place somebody like Al Gore in the story of Hollywood and politics, somebody who was deeply entrenched in politics before he had this massively influential film?
He's very much on the periphery. Mm-hmm. He's not part of Hollywood. He only used it, like most politicians, his contacts with Hollywood, up to the point he made the film, were to use them for fundraising. He never had the kind of relationship that Bill Clinton did, where Bill Clinton loved Hollywood, Hollywood loved Bill Clinton. Gore, even to this day, even with his documentary, he is not a figure here at all.
Talk about, with Clinton in particular, you have people courting him for the power that he has, and was he doing the same thing, and did everybody sort of understand that, you know, he loves Hollywood and Hollywood loves him, and it's about what each can do for the other?
He did, and, you know, I interviewed also George Dukakis for the book, and Dukakis was at the other end.
Mm-hmm.
He said, I have limited time to campaign, and I don't want to spend that with movie stars. You know, I'll spend some time with them, and, you know, they're very bright, but I don't want to be identified with Hollywood. Where Clinton felt not only would he get money, very important money, but he felt that actually the glamour and celebrity of Hollywood would help him a great deal. And I think he was right. And again, you know, going back to something we talked about at the beginning with Arnold Schwarzenegger in the talk shows, Clinton at one point early in the 1992 campaign was in third place, trailing Bush and, I just went brain dead for a minute, your Texan.
Ross Perot.
Ross Perot. Thank you. And then he went on 10 entertainment shows in the course of a month and used those shows as a way to, you know, Arsenio Hall and all the others, and used them as a way to talk about his policies. And at the end of that month, he was number one in the polls.
Hmm.
So he got that the, you know, Hollywood and the entertainment industry writ large were a way of reaching voters that went beyond the traditional beltway politics.
Was it on MTV that Clinton answered the question about boxers or briefs?
I believe it was.
Mm-hmm.
And it also, you know, he wanted to get a younger audience there, and he thought doing this would be a hip way to do it, and I think he was right.
So how is this all playing out now? What are you seeing in Hollywood and in Washington that sort of tells you the direction of the future?
Well, it's way too early to tell. Mm-hmm. Right now, you don't see endorsements coming out. You don't see the stars speaking out yet. They will start, my guess is it's going to happen closer to around January. And even on the left, they've been very silent about Obama. And to the extent that I've seen, certainly not visible. I mean, I read Variety. I'm looking at the LA Times, New York Times. I haven't seen any of the stars come out yet with pronouncements. I think they're all waiting to see how things play out over the next few, certainly the next few weeks, if not the next few months.
Do the parties these days have equal access to the sort of influence of really well-staged conventions and ads? I mean, is there any difference, not in terms of the substance of what they're talking about, but in terms of production values?
Oh, no, I think they both get it. Mm-hmm. They're both trying to make their conventions more entertaining. They're trying to get their messages snappier than they've been before, and they really understand the impact of media. And this has less to do with Hollywood, per se, than staging a good show. And as Arnold Schwarzenegger said, to be successful, a party needs a good storyline. What are you going to sell to voters? And to that extent, I think the Republicans have been more successful than the Democrats. They've had a much better storyline. And that storyline since World War II is, with variations, America is the greatest nation in the world. What more do you need to know?
Hmm.
And that, you know, voters don't want to hear a Jane Fonda or a Sean Penn complain about what's wrong with America. They want the same values that Louis B. Mayer talked about: optimism, mobility, success, family, God, country. This is the stuff the GOP has been hammering home, again, for well over 50, 60 years. And the Democrats have never created a storyline as effective, except in the last election. Barack Obama changed the traditional Democratic mantra has been hope and guilt.
Hmm.
You know, hope for what America can be, guilt that we aren't doing more. And that never played so well. And instead, Obama changed it to hope and change we can believe in. And, you know, really created a kind of sense of optimism. And
film historian Stephen J. Ross is author of the new book Hollywood Left and Right: How Movie Stars Shaped American Politics. Steve, it's been a fascinating discussion. Thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Well, thank you, Chris. I appreciate it, and I appreciate your listeners calling in.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
The Think production team includes engineer Nilufer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.